Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Hong Kong for an update on the continuing demonstrations that have grown in size and determination against Hong Kong's chief executive, who is increasingly seen as a stooge of the Chinese Communist Party in the Chinese Communist government in Beijing. Michael Davis, Professor of Law at the University of Hong Kong, joins us on China's National Day, marking the 65th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China, to discuss how far the demonstrators can push the envelope before the leadership in Beijing cracks down. Then we will speak with Graham Fuller, the former Vice Chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and author of Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. We will discuss Turkey's moment of decision in terms of dealing with the mess they have helped create next door in Syria, and Graham Fuller's article at the Huffington Post, Embracing Assad is a Better Strategy for the U.S. Than Supporting the Least Bad Jihadis, which makes a case for the U.S. to recognize its policy in Syria has failed and to swallow the bitter pill of joining with the despicable Assad regime to eliminate the Islamic State, or ISIL. Then finally, we'll look into the two-day visit by India's new Prime Minister Narendra Modi to Washington and the White House, where President Obama gave him a state dinner at which Prime Minister Modi did not eat because he is engaged in a religious fast. Sumit Ganguly, the chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University and author of India Since 1980 and India, Pakistan and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia, joins us to discuss the rock-star welcome Modi is getting from the Indian diaspora and the demonstrations against him. And joining us now from Hong Kong is Michael Davis, a professor of law at the University of Hong Kong and previously a professor of human rights law at Northwestern University Law School. His books include Constitutional Confrontation in Hong Kong, Human Rights and Chinese Values, and International Intervention from Power Politics to Global Responsibility. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Davis.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I believe it's around 9 a.m. on Wednesday in Hong Kong. And
8 a.m., yeah.
It's 8 a.m. Oh, I'm so sorry for getting you up so early.
Don't worry.
But you're getting up at 8 a.m. on China's National Day, the 65th anniversary of the founding of the PRC. So how will these demonstrations rain on Xi Jinping's parade?
Well, this is the situation is really, you know, the number of demonstrators and everything has grown dramatically over the last 24 hours. I was left late last night where they were demonstrating, so sometimes it tapers off a little bit overnight, and I don't know, I haven't had a chance this early in the morning to see whether there are reports on that. But there's no question, they're going to fill up all the space and more today. So this is going to be a very huge demonstrations in Hong Kong.
So is this heading to a situation where Xi Jinping and the Communist Party in Beijing have a choice between either losing face or implementing violence?
I hope it's more than face for them, but I think you're right. That's certainly a major issue for Chinese leaders. What one would like to see is the Hong Kong government step up, not with tear gas, but with efforts to talk to Beijing and help them to understand what Hong Kong concerns are. They've been very poor at doing that over many months that these issues have been debated and virtually misrepresented when they had a consultation exercise. Represented the Hong Kong views, because what they reported really, as we can see by these demonstrations, in no way reflected Hong Kong views. Their report suggested a kind of support for Beijing's designs for elections. So now I think they've got a clear message from Hong Kong people, so I would hope they would intercede in some ways. You know, at the end of the day, this right now is a battle for the hearts and minds of Hong Kong people, because the demonstrators aren't really confident that Beijing's going to back down. They know Beijing too well. So I think there's a kind of contest between the Hong Kong government and the protesters, and the protesters have clearly won round one in this battle.
But is there any polling on exactly how much of the 7.2 million residents of Hong Kong support these protests, or how many people are nervous about an economic downturn and other negative effects of a crackdown from Beijing, or just, and I assume that there is some support for the PRC in Hong Kong.
There's definitely support. There's always been support, a so-called pro-Beijing camp in Hong Kong. And the business elites have always also been very supportive of Beijing. So these people definitely are not happy with what's going on. But when you go out on the streets here, it's hard to imagine that there's not widespread support. It's like the entire youth of the city. I mean, even the ones that are not in the area where the protest is at are all wearing black and on the trains and everything. It's just last night I was almost stunned by the level of support. And you see their parents also showing up sometimes with these, they have these little yellow ribbons and so on. And I think the polling is showing that the protesters have quite a bit of support. And a lot of this is the result of how heavy-handed the police were out of the gate, you know, when this first began, by gassing people, something Hong Kong people really had never seen. There have been some use of tear gas a decade ago when Korean protesters came to a WTO meeting, but really there's never been use of it on Hong Kong people. And so this has shocked people, and I think it really increased the turnout dramatically. I know the CE well understands that, and that's why now you don't see the police around there very much. So, and it's very peaceful. So I don't know where it's headed, but that's sort of where it's at right now.
And again, I'm speaking to Michael Davis, who is in Hong Kong, where he's a professor of law at the University of Hong Kong and previously a professor of human rights law at Northwestern University Law School. His books include Constitutional Confrontation in Hong Kong, Human Rights and Chinese Values, and International Intervention from Power Politics to Global Responsibility. On Tuesday, the Chinese leader Xi Jinping told the Communist Party leaders in Beijing that his government would, quoting, unswervingly implement the guidelines of one country, two systems, and the basic law, and steadfastly safeguard the long-term prosperity and stability of Hong Kong and Macau. Now, given Xi's pedigree of coming from, he's a princeling son of a military leader that was close to Mao Zedong, and apparently I don't know whether this guy is really a throwback in terms of being a communist ideologue, or that's just, you know, that's their power base, and while they're getting rich, they have to maintain the fiction of communism. What's your reading on this guy?
Well, I think he's a hardliner. I think communism nowadays is just rhetoric. You invoke Mao or something to show, you know, your legitimacy, and this is, you know, that you're upholding the communist revolution or whatever. But I think basically he has come across as a hardliner, and the problem for Hong Kong people in this dispute is they don't believe that they're upholding the one country, two systems model and the basic law, that the basic law promises universal suffrage, a high degree of autonomy, and they have essentially withdrawn it. They've dismissed the Sino-British Treaty that brought about this one country, two systems model. So it's really, that's where the disjuncture's at. They claim to be upholding it, and that's exactly why people are demonstrating, because they're not.
So could a compromise position be that the chief executive, CYL, I guess is the way they refer to him, you think that's in the cards, that rather than have a confrontation and have PRC soldiers on the streets repeating the Tiananmen Square agony, which I believe is a shadow that hangs over the leadership in Beijing, would that be a compromise position to essentially ease out the current leader and put a friendlier face there and not necessarily change rules?
Right, that's exactly, well, it wouldn't be sufficient, but that's the first step that's been demanded by the protesters, that the current CE resign. They feel that he never really steps up for Hong Kong, that there's a wide perception in Hong Kong that the government only represents Beijing. So this creates a kind of sense of almost like Hong Kong's been colonized. And that's not what's promised in the one country, two systems model and the basic law and so on. So that's one of their demands. But at the end of the day, there has to be someone who can speak to Beijing, has Beijing's ear, and who's willing to be honest about what feelings are here. I think one of the big problems is for years the pro-Beijing camp sort of misrepresents Hong Kong views in a sense in ways that are favorable to their hold on power. So Hong Kong people, I think, are rather upset about it, and that's kind of what's going on here on the streets.
So it's probably difficult to figure out whether the Chinese leadership in Beijing are reading the fact that the Hong Kong people want the one country, two systems to be real. And they're probably getting fed a kind of echo chamber type of propaganda. What the mainland Chinese media is saying, they're blaming radical opposition forces for stirring up this trouble. They're suggesting that this is a fringe.
Right. In fact, they often blame it on foreign interference. Except these, I know these people who are involved in this. There's no way foreigners are typically they're pointing their finger at the United States, that foreigners are sort of meddling behind the scenes and instructing and guiding these efforts. These efforts, I would say their foreign influence is virtually nil on it. What's really their objection, I suppose, it's the foreign ideas as they perceive it, democracy and human rights and so on. So when they call about foreign interference, it's often this, they see these ideas that they object to, which they view as threatening. And so that's what's going on. It's certainly not a fringe anymore. It might have been more of a fringe in the beginning when Benny Tai said they were going to occupy Central. But at this point, the behavior of Beijing in ignoring Hong Kong concerns and the behavior of the Hong Kong government in how it's handled these matters has turned this into, I would say, probably a majority of Hong Kong people.
So what is your sense then of whether the Chinese leadership are in an echo chamber where they believe what they're told, what they want to be told, and they believe what they want to believe, or do they recognize that the people in Hong Kong want this agreement to be real, the one that was signed with the British in 1996 and expires in 2047?
I think they are really in that echo chamber. It's unfortunate. And so this is why I think any effort to bridge the gap in perceptions needs some of their supporters in Hong Kong to step up and actually talk to people and see if there's a way out, talk to Beijing. I think that's where the problem lies.
And what's the likelihood of that? If this guy's being...
Go ahead.
I was just saying, if this guy, the chief executive, is under siege and being lampooned and told to get out of town, is he a kind of hard-head sycophant of the Chinese or leadership, or does he have any indications or any sign of independence?
Well, it's not been very visible, his sign of independence, in this process that's unfolded over the last 6 months. There are some people here, I think, that have Beijing's ear, that also understand Hong Kong. The head of the Legislative Council is a pro-Beijing figure, and he named Song Yuk-sing, and a lot of people thought he should be instrumental in this effort to close the gap. I think, and I know he can talk to the Democrats because he's worked with them in the Legislative Council for years. So I think there are people that can do that. And I would think some of the business elite could also carry out that role, because China places high emphasis on protecting the interest of investors and so on. So I think there are ways for people to have a dialogue where Beijing actually is allowed to listen to some real views. Whether Beijing wants to hear those views or not is another matter, because mainland leaders these days, they think they're very successful, and they're a bit more arrogant, I think, than they have been in the past.
Well, just in closing, is there any evidence that the contagion of democracy is spreading to China?
I think that there's no evidence of it as far as I've seen. Chinese people on their own have their government and have reasons to, you know, there are dissident voices in China. But I think in the beginning, the Hong Kong model of one country, two systems really successfully hived off Hong Kong. So I don't think Hong Kong's having all these freedoms it's had for years and finally realizing the democracy that was promised poses that great a threat to China. There's this argument that somehow if that happens, then a domino effect will go on. But I think Chinese people have long accepted that Hong Kong, like New York, is just another place, a place that has its own system, one country, two systems. And so I don't see it as posing that danger. That danger exists independent of Hong Kong.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Davis.
You're welcome.
Again, I was speaking to Michael Davis, who's in Hong Kong, where he's a professor of law at the University of Hong Kong and previously was a professor of human rights at Northwestern University Law School. His books include Constitutional Confrontation in Hong Kong, Human Rights and Chinese Values, and International Intervention from Power Politics to Global Responsibility. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking to a former senior CIA official who thinks that the United States should swallow the bitter pill and make a deal with Assad in Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, World Without Islam, and Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Embracing Assad is a Better Strategy for the U.S. than Supporting the Least Bad Jihadis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
So this, of course, is a pretty bitter pill for the U.S. to swallow, given former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's proclamation that Assad was going to fall. And there is, however, I think, pretty obvious evidence, is there not, that as the U.S. bombs the Islamic State or ISIL in Syria, Assad is now free to turn his guns on the Free Syrian Army, the very people who the U.S. support, so, and who want to commit another $500 million worth of arms and training to. So that in itself is a pretty glaring contradiction, isn't it?
Well, exactly. I think the whole problem has been fraught with this contradiction since the very beginning, but they're growing worse. And by the way, I did not choose that title for the article saying that dealing with Assad was better than dealing with the most moderate jihadis.
Yeah.
That was the newspaper put that in. But certainly I make the case that it's very hard to find moderate jihadis that are going to be sufficiently capable of battling Assad and sufficiently moderate that we could sit down, we could contemplate them in government, much less arrange it.
But in a sense, the history of the U.S. recently has been one of toppling secular Arab leaders, starting with Saddam Hussein and then Gaddafi. And Assad hasn't fallen, but that's not because the U.S. hasn't wanted him to fall. So what do you think is behind that? Because invariably it leads to empowering the worst kind of Islamist radicals.
Well, it does, and those cases that you've cited is exactly what we've seen. Unfortunately, there are not really very many alternatives out there. The leaders who have been secular dictators have generally had the only opposition they face has come from the Islamists. So when they fall, the Islamists tend to be the natural beneficiary. And indeed, in Egypt, to nobody's surprise, the Muslim Brotherhood actually won by a small margin the election. So, you know, all of us think how nice it would be to have liberal, secularist, modernists, moderates in power, but they represent such a tiny part of the political spectrum in these countries that it's an impossible expectation that that they would actually make it to power and hold on to power.
So is there any chance, do you think, that the U.S., in the case of Assad and Syria, could swallow the bitter pill of realpolitik?
Well, I think it's probably coming in the sense in that the whole Islamic State issue has suddenly now leapt to the forefront of U.S. concerns in the region far more urgently than the overthrow of the Assad government itself has ever been. I mean, we've seen how slowly Obama, and even reluctantly and cautiously, Obama has moved against Assad to whether he would actually bomb Syria or not. We've seen that caution, but there's been no caution, relatively speaking, towards choking or destroying the Islamic State. So I doubt that it's possible to do both. And therefore, I suspect that Washington, without ever saying it, without ever admitting it, is probably going to simply either look the other way or come to terms quietly with Assad, or simply lessen, if not end, aid to the range of jihadi forces that have been battling him, whether they be considered moderate or less moderate.
Again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his latest is Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Embracing Assad is a Better Strategy for the U.S. Than Supporting the Least Bad Jihadis, and the caveat being that you didn't choose that headline. But what is then the likelihood of, isn't it likely, Graham Fuller, that in President Obama's long conversations on the phone with Vladimir Putin, Putin has made this suggestion, you know, that the best way to get rid of the Islamic State is to work with Assad, and the whole thing will be over and the destruction of Syria will stop. And the country has been largely destroyed, and a third of its population has been displaced, and over 200,000 people have died, and there are countless in prison. And that, of course, is one of the reasons why Assad is so distasteful, is how he treats his own people. And I imagine also in these negotiations with the Iranians over the nuclear issue, which is coming to a head now, the Iranians have probably made all kinds of suggestions along those lines. Is there any, well, let's begin with this. Do you think that the Iranians and the Russians could in any way lean on Assad? Assuming it gets to the point where the U.S. wants to make a deal, but they need to get rid of Assad because they simply can't abide him. Could those other backers of the regime find a cosmetic way to get somebody else in there?
Well, of course, Assad is distasteful, but it's important to remember that he was not He was nothing like a Saddam Hussein, say, in the days in which there were no insurrections taking place in Syria. So it's become vastly uglier as a result of those insurrections and then the internationalization of that insurrection with backing from Saudi Arabia and Turkey and from the United States and others. So I think it is. I don't think Putin or Russia has any strong brief for Assad as such. I think they have even said that more or less. But the problem is now I think both Iran and Russia would be loath to see a government replacing Assad that would be, say, an immediate ally of the West. First of all, I don't think that's a realistic thing. I don't think that's going to happen. If there were moderate jihadis who take over a Muslim Brotherhood or whatever, they may be moderate, but they're not going to become allies of the West. So I think the fear that any new regime is really going to be an ally of the West on the part of either Iran or Russia is perhaps exaggerated. On top of that, I doubt very much that all the powers that be among the Alawi leadership, the Alawi community, I doubt that they are going to would consider overthrowing or dumping Assad in the middle of chaos and war. That would simply be a huge sign of weakness, a huge emboldening of the anti-Assad crowd. So I suspect that if we want to get rid of Assad as such, the situation is probably going to have to be considerably tamped down, become quieter, and leaving the Alawite broader regime comfortable that they could put Assad on a plane out of the country without having that bring down the entire system. So I think those are some of the calculations that are at work.
But there's no evidence that any of these discussions are going on. At this point, the U.S. is making it clear that while they're attacking the Islamic State or ISIL in Syria, they're also opposed to Assad, even though his foreign minister at the UN the other day more or less suggested that the U.S. and Syria are allies.
Well, that was a self-serving comment, I'm sure, and trying to put some pressure on Obama. But in terms of the Islamic State, indeed, they are de facto allies, as Iran is and as is Russia. So I just wish that Washington would get over this long-term hang-up of finding it very difficult finding it impossible to deal with Iran on these issues. I'm heartened that with these nuclear negotiations, and I actually think that they're probably going to work for a variety of reasons, but I wish we were a little more willing to deal in greater depth with Iran on the question of Syria as well. Who knows? Those talks may be taking place quietly out of the public view. I don't know. But we just can't judge the Syrian situation by saying, oh, my God, if Russia benefits or if Iran benefits, then that's got to be bad. It's possible that Iran can benefit, Russia can benefit, and we can benefit, and the region can benefit, and Turkey can benefit, if this war is allowed to come to an end. I say that with no particular satisfaction or joy. It will be a modest setback, and I certainly don't like to see Assad emerge strongly in this situation. But he has been grievously damaged, even if he's holding on to power. So the future of Syria is not going to be simply a bloodthirsty dictator. I think they've got to, they're going to have to rejig their entire policies, both domestic and foreign, if they're going to have a state in the future that's viable.
And Graham Fuller, did you happen to read or see the Rouhani, the new Iranian leader's speech at the UN?
No, I haven't had a chance to see that yet.
Well, it was actually quite interesting and quite sober and quite realistic. I thought, of course, we don't know the extent to which what autonomy he has, but he seems like a very reasonable person and somebody that one could deal with. And your feeling is, and I've heard this from other people too, is that this nuclear deal may actually come to fruition.
Yeah, and I'm not even following the details of it, which are exceedingly complex and technical. But I just, having watched the region for most of my life, I just have a feeling in my bones that this time around, the body language is different, the talk is different, the situation is different, the pace, the faces and personalities are different. I think there's a very good chance that this is going to work. And if it works on that in that area, then I think some effort to try to deal with these extreme jihadis in both within Iraq and Syria can find some cooperation from Syria and, as I say, from Russia, Turkey, and others. The big question mark is Saudi Arabia, because they were one of the early ones to slap down big bucks and insert their own radical jihadis onto the scene. Now, how willing they will be to back off is unknown, but Riyadh's refusal to deal with Iran seems to have already been under some considerable change. I think they recognize that this is the U.S.-Iranian rapprochement is probably going to come about. They don't want to be left out of this, and typically they are now back-channel negotiations themselves.
So turning to Turkey, which has been the odd man out in terms of the anti-ISIS coalition, I think 26 nations met in Paris recently, including Russia and China, to develop a collective strategy against the Islamic State. And Turkey, obviously, with sharing borders with Syria and Iraq, one would think that they would be extremely involved. And of course, there's an important NATO base in Incirlik. But there are reports now, as this battle is underway between ISIL in Syria and the Kurds, the Syrian Kurds, the Democratic Union Party, the Syrian Kurdish PYD, are charging that Turkey's military are in cahoots with what they call Daesh, the jihadis, and that Islamist fighters are coming across from Turkey.
Well, I think Turkey is in a nearly intolerable situation, and it's a situation that they have created for themselves. I have immense respect for Turkish foreign policy in the years preceding. I think they made major steps forward towards starting to deal with all the countries of the region. And they were strongly supportive of regime change as the Arab Spring got underway in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya and Yemen and elsewhere. Then when Assad began to face some armed uprisings, Turkey assumed that Assad too would be quick to fall. Turkey made that mistake, but so did Washington, and so did most other countries in the world. It was not an unreasonable assumption to make, perhaps, at that time. In any case, they were badly burned by it. They threw in good money after bad. Were determined that they were, that they simply got angrier and angrier. Erdogan personally as well, and were just determined that he has to go. So they began, I think, to take a much softer line towards jihadi elements fighting in Iraq and Syria against Assad. But now this has turned around to bite them. Turkey has become somewhat isolated from other countries now because they have been unwilling to get on the bandwagon. One very good reason, I'm sure, as you know, is that for many months, ISIS was holding some 48 diplomatic Turkish diplomatic hostages in Iraq. So I think this probably was a situation in which they really were terrified that if they moved against ISIS, they could or the Islamic State, they could find themselves, they could find all of their diplomats slaughtered. So I suspect that was the primary reason for caution, apart from having to eat a lot of public crow as well over if they are forced to change their policy. And I think they will be forced to, if not already are doing so, quietly.
Well, just in closing, though, Graham Fuller, Turkey has apparently granted asylum to the Syrian and Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood who were expelled from Doha, Qatar, under pressure from the U.S. So what's the significance of that?
I had not heard that the brothers were expelled from Doha under U.S. pressure. Certainly, I know that under Gulf pressure, Saudi and UAE and others, there was great pressure, nearly intolerable pressure on Doha. But I don't think for a second that Qatar has given up its general sympathy for the Muslim Brotherhood and support to it. I think that once the situation quiets down, that they will probably allow these Muslim Brotherhood leaders back in. And after all, I mean, by now, the Muslim Brotherhood looks absolutely like, Western Democrats supporting free elections and embracing a whole number of other issues of Western governance. So I don't think it's dealing with the Brotherhood is in any way undesirable. In fact, the best the U.S. or anyone else could hope for if jihadis or, let's say, Islamists take over in Syria, it would be that they be from the Muslim Brotherhood because they are a known quantity. Their leadership has lived in the West in London for a long time. They're not crazy-eyed killers like the Islamic State. I think most people would view it as a pretty good alternative if we have to go the route of a Islamist government post Assad.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his latest, Turkey in the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Embracing Assad is a Better Strategy for the U.S. Than Supporting the Least Bad Jihadis. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the state dinner in Washington, D.C. for the Prime Minister of India, who did not eat because he's on a religious fast. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. His books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, and India Since 1980. And his latest book, co-authored with S. Paul Kapoor, is India, Pakistan, and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sumit Ganguly.
It's a delight to be back.
And President Obama met with the Prime Minister Narendra Modi in the White House on Tuesday and talked about a new agenda between their countries. And apparently the two leaders bonded because they're both kind of computer geeks. That's my understanding. Is that what you heard?
Yes, I've heard that. And also, you know, both of them to use a more charitable term, let's say they're sort of technocratically inclined. they particularly Modi wants various kinds of technocratic solutions to all manner of problems that plague India, the delivery of various kinds of services, cutting through bureaucratic red tape. Certainly, yes.
Well, of course, outside of the meeting in the White House, there were demonstrations pro and con Narendra Modi. Still, there's a lot of concern about what happened in Gujarat when he was in charge of the state when there were a violent pogrom against Muslims. Then you have to contrast that with the kind of rock star status that he was greeted with recently at Madison Square Garden in New York. What did you make of that particular gathering in New York?
Well, that gathering simply represents the fact that large numbers of individuals in the Indian diaspora in this country are prepared to overlook what transpired in Gujarat in February 2002. And they take refuge in the fact that the Indian Supreme Court, for a lack of evidence, said that we cannot convict Modi of anything. Insufficient evidence was the conclusion that they reached. And for the vast majority of these individuals, that's a good enough verdict. And consequently, here is someone who is prepared to take India into the 21st century, who promises to transform India's economy, to promote economic growth, to ensure shared prosperity, and also wants a militarily robust India. He sounds someone who appears quite appealing. And they are prepared to sort of burnish him and to sanitize a certain past. And that explains the enthusiasm with which he was greeted.
And, of course, he was banned from coming to the United States by the State Department until he became the head of state. But it was a bit odd at the dinner on Monday night in the White House hosted by the Obamas. Mr. Modi did not eat because of he's on a 9-day religious fast. He is an extremely religious and abstemious character, is he not?
He certainly is abstemious. One wonders about how deep this religiosity runs. It certainly serves a very powerful political purpose by coming across as someone who is quite Spartan in his personal habits, who makes a show of his religious commitments and rigorously adheres to them, even when traveling abroad and meeting no less a personality than the President of the United States. That plays very well politically. Whether this is instrumental or whether this is a product of deep religious conviction, this is anybody's guess, quite frankly.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington, and he is the author most recently of With S. Paul Kapoor of India, Pakistan, and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. But it seems that his appeal, which was made very clear at the big kind of rock star rally that he had at Madison Square Garden with the Indian diaspora, is that he wants India to have its place in the sun, to be recognized as a major power and a rising global power at that. He's also apparently very popular because there's a sense that he may actually take care of the poor in that country and perhaps undo the caste system, since he has such humble origins as the son of a tea seller or a chaiwala, as they're called.
Right. Yes, people have reposed considerable hopes in him, expecting him to not only generate economic growth, but also produce a degree of equity. And in considerable part, these hopes exist because the last 5 years, there was a distinct sense of disarray that had gripped the Congress-led government in New Delhi. The government seemed incapable of governing. It was racked with a series of scandals. It pursued a number of policies which were widely unpopular, and especially with the business community. They undertook a series of decisions which led to the drying up of both domestic and foreign investment. And Modi comes across, at least thus far, as the very antithesis thereof. So now the task before him is to deliver on these extraordinary expectations that he has generated.
So, Sumit Ganguly, what do we make of the demonstration in front of the White House in Lafayette Park, where a group of Indian American Sikhs chanted, "Who is a terrorist, Modi? Who is a butcher, Modi?" What is it that the Sikhs have against him? Is it to do with the religious riots in Gujarat?
Well, it's interesting that the Sikhs should protest against him because they were not the victims in the Gujarat pogrom of February 2002. The principal victims were Muslims who suffered grievously during that particular tragedy. But the Sikhs have other grievances, and I suspect they're simply making common cause with the Muslims. The Sikhs should really direct their anger at the Congress Party and what transpired after the death of Indira Gandhi in October 1984, when thousands of Sikhs were literally butchered in the streets of New Delhi. And apart from a few small fry, hardly any of the politicians who were in power and who have been implicated by civil rights and human rights organizations have basically gotten away scot-free. And if the Sikhs really want to focus their grievances, it's against those individuals that they should direct their wrath. Modi seems like an unlikely figure for the Sikhs.
Well, there's no question that there's an awful lot to blame the Congress Party for. Is that not the case? I mean, it seems that so much of the appeal that Modi has and his Hindu fundamentalist party is simply the absolute disgust and exhaustion that the Indian people have with the long-ruling Congress Party. It's sort of similar to what had happened in Mexico after the 70-year reign of the PRI party.
That's exactly right. But the last 5 years of Congress in particular were marked with widespread financial irregularities, with a singular incapacity to deliver governance, and also a series of economic missteps. So all of this has led to a certain kind of congealed anger and frustration, and thereby a turn towards someone who seems very pragmatic and who seems to promise a very different kind of future for Indian citizenry.
Well, the president took Prime Minister Modi for a stroll through the Martin Luther King Memorial, and I take it that was pretty symbolic. What do you think? What was the point the president was trying to make there?
Well, King, of course, was the very antithesis of Modi. Modi is a highly divisive figure. Modi evokes strong emotions, both amongst his supporters and his detractors, whereas King is someone who genuinely sought to bring together America to try and heal racial divisions. And obviously, Obama, as the first African-American president, has to pay a certain amount of obeisance, more than others, to the legacy of Dr. King, an absolutely extraordinary individual. And also King has a certain intellectual and philosophical affinity with someone from Modi's state, no less, Mohandas Gandhi, one of the apostles of nonviolence and one of the principal leaders of the Indian nationalist movement, if not the father of the Indian nationalist movement. So the walk was obviously fraught with symbolism, both in terms of sort of a reminder to Modi about the importance of healing wounds and the importance of bringing people together, but also invoking a deeper memory, the memory of Gandhi and militant nonviolence, something that Dr. King very effectively adopted in this country to transform this country in many ways.
So given that Martin Luther King was inspired by Mahatma Gandhi's civil disobedience tactics, on Tuesday, Mr. Modi visited the statue of Mahatma Gandhi in Washington, D.C. So there seems to be a kind of a little coincidence there, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it was quite deliberate that by invoking Gandhi, he's trying to portray a very different image of himself. That now that he is the prime minister, he really is trying to sort of cloak himself in a very different approach and a very different outlook. And obviously, since the statue is directly opposite the Indian Embassy in Washington, D.C., not paying some sort of public homage would be an enormous public relations disaster.
So what's happening, though, in terms of just to talk about Indian politics, which, of course, are almost a sport in India? I mean, it's the world's largest democracy, but the media, you know, they slice and dice politics in a way that makes, you know, political wonks on MSNBC look like lightweights. I mean, it's an amazing political culture in India where so much attention is paid to political minutiae. But recently, this very colorful, she's a communist leader, just got jailed. Tell me about what's happening, what happened there.
Yes. After 18 years of litigation, Jayalalitha Jayaram, a populist and a imperious leader in the state of Tamil Nadu, the chief minister of the state, was finally convicted of having assets disproportionate to income in this very quaint legal jargon. And she's been sentenced to prison for 4 years. She's obviously going to appeal and try and tie up the court in knots in further legal proceedings. But I think this time, higher courts are unlikely to be especially sympathetic towards her. In the past, she has managed to successfully appeal and gotten various kinds of decisions against her set aside by higher courts. But this time, I think the evidence is fairly robust, and it is going to be exceedingly difficult to resort to legal maneuverings and dexterity to manage to escape the long arm of the law. I would like to believe that her political career is now in eclipse.
Now, was I correct in labeling her as a communist, or what is her party?
No, she's not a communist. She's a populist leader. She is referred to as Amma, which means mother. She has created a series of sort of welfare programs in this state. But at the same time, from at least the indictment, it seems that she has nicely lined her own coffers.
So, but isn't that southern area that she's from where the communists are the most, they have the most electoral representation?
No, not from her state. The communist representation is from another southern state, but on the west coast of India, Kerala, which has long been a communist stronghold.
Right. I was confusing it with Kerala, right. So just to return then to Narendra Modi, and again, these demonstrations against him, particularly by the Indian-American Sikhs, quoting one of the leaders of the demonstration, Modi organized and took the lead in the violence. He's a religious extremist. And they were also saying, and just like the rise of Hitler and the Nazis who blamed the Jews for the problems of Germany, Modi and his ideology blame Muslims and others for the problems of India. That's the leader of the Khalistan Affairs Center, a group in Washington that advocates for a separate Sikh nation as a part of India. So How fair are those analogies, given that...
I frankly think that's rather overwrought. I think that's clearly overstated. I think Modi might be a divisive figure, but to suggest that Modi is something comparable to Hitler, I think, is a gross overstatement. And the Khalistanis have long wanted a separate state in the Punjab. They wanted to secede from India. And Modi is simply the latest prime minister to face their wrath and their unhappiness. They would probably do this to any other Indian prime minister. Modi just happens to be a particularly divisive figure, and thereby Modi is attracting this kind of opprobrium.
But just in closing, though, Sumit Ganguly, it would seem to me that that is not the kind of leader that India needs. First of all, India has more Muslims than the state of Pakistan has, and by and large, they live in pretty much in harmony with the Hindu majority. But there are all kinds of religious minorities in India itself as well. So it would seem to me that you really need somebody that can reach out to all of India's diverse religions and languages and cultures.
I think that's exactly right. And one hopes that now that he's in office and he's no longer in charge of mostly a homogeneous state, he will recognize India's extraordinary cultural diversity and the country's extraordinary linguistic diversity, religious diversity, and the like, and thereby rule the country in an inclusive fashion and not seek to exclude or demonize or maltreat any minority community.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. And his books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, and India Since 1980. And his latest book, co-authored with S. Paul Kapoor, is India, Pakistan and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.